Good morning, everybody. Today is not just a great day, it's a fabulous day. My name's Stu Turley, and President and CEO of the Sandstone Group, and I'm here with a very, very special guest. We've got Don Deers. He's got lots of books out there, and we've got two of them here to talk about. But let me tell you a little bit about Don. Don is a Korean vet. He is an author. He's a man about town, and I guarantee we're going to have a fun discussion. Don, thank you so much for stopping by.
Well, it's great. I'm glad to be with you.
Oh, I'll tell you, as you can tell, I get a little excited talking about things and everything else. And we were just chit-chatting right before here. Thank you for your service to our country. And tell us a little bit. You were in Korea. You were in Navy and on a couple of ships. Tell us just a little bit about your background in the military.
Well, I was on active duty during the Korean War on a couple of different ships. They were service ships. I mean, one was an oiler and the other was a refrigerated cargo ship. So what we did was provided the food to the other Navy ships during underway replenishment.
Nice.
And I was chief engineering officer in one of them and damage control officer in the other.
Ooh. Damage control guys they got to not make a mistake.
Well, that was an interesting. I mean, when I first got called up to active duty, I went to the 4 to 6 week damage control school. At that time, was in Philadelphia, and it was a great experience. I learned a great deal. Atomic, biological, and chemical warfare.
Wow.
Among other things, which were very, very, at that time, you know, a long time ago, but at that time, it was very front and center.
Wow. Well, so how did you get from damage control to damage control and energy? Because your books, I just want to give a shout out, The Looming Energy Crisis, Are Blackouts Inevitable? You have other books as well. And then this one that I really went through is Clean Energy Crisis, The Challenge of Replacing Fossil Fuels. And Don, before we get into this, you did an outstanding job going through the numbers. So damage control by the numbers should be the tagline under you.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay.
But what got you started in your industry energy expert?
Well, after I left the Navy, I went to work for General Electric on their manufacturing management program, which was essentially an internal MBA program. And I spent 3 years on that. But basically, I spent my entire career at General Electric working in different product industries, locomotives, steam turbines, transformers, DC motors, small jet engines. And I spent, you know, some time in each of those businesses, which was a great experience.
Right.
And then, of course, later on during the career, I set up established companies overseas in, I don't know how many countries, several countries, to establish companies that would service GE gas turbines and other products.
Mm.
So I, you know, set them up everywhere from Bahrain to Singapore. Let's put it that way.
Wow. And so when did you get the writing bug?
After I, as an engineer, one doesn't expect engineers to be writers, but After I retired, I started to get interested in very, very early into this Kyoto fiasco that we went through around 2000. And that just got me very interested in that subject. And then that led me to start writing articles. And I had a blog, still have a blog. And I went from articles to books.
Fantastic. Well, I'm a wannabe. I'm working on some things right now. So I think that's one of the reasons that I really enjoyed this, because when we're out there and we're talking, there's people that flap and then there's people that talk facts. And so I'm always needing to fact check myself. So anybody that gets your book needs to keep it on their desk, because facts don't lie. And so dedicated to my great, great grandchildren and all the other children in America. I'm sorry. That's pretty darn cool. So there's a couple things in here that first grab as we go through here. Sorry. I just really enjoyed the book. That's fun. You can tell here. Big government with its bureaucracy, as well as big business, are on board with the climate and CO2 clean energy crisis. That kind of sets the whole stage for where everything is going right now, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. I mean, it appears as though most businesses are supporting this idea that CO2 or supporting the idea that fossil fuels must be eliminated. And obviously, that's the government position at this point in time. And yet, when you start to dig into the facts surrounding the use of fossil fuels and the alternatives, you suddenly realize that you can't eliminate fossil fuels. They're too important and too pervasive, and they're too efficient and low cost.
Right. You know, I'm of the opinion we need to get low cost energy to everyone in the world and let the markets decide while having the least amount of impact on the environment. Okay. That there are some places that renewables do make sense. Nuclear, love nuclear. Yeah, Hawaii. Right. I mean, you can't ship things to Hawaii very easily. Okay. Solar, wind might make sense there, but you got to have the numbers and let the market per kilowatt hour come down a lot. You got some facts in here also, but you first start off at fossil fuels and geopolitical. Geopolitical is such a big animal in this game. You talk about China wanting to displace the U.S. That makes a big difference as well, too.
Oh, yeah, there's no question. I mean, China has evolved into our major competitor, both in the point of view of industry, but also from the point of view of strategy. They, at this point in time, are on a path that is to displace the United States as the leading economy in the world. And that's their plan. In fact, Pillsbury's book goes through. They have a 50-year plan to replace the United States.
I'll tell you, I love your quote in here. The lower cost of energy, the greater its effect on economic growth and prosperity.
Actually, that I think I've coined that, but I think that's the absolute truth.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And we're blessed in the United States for having just a huge reserves of fossil fuels that allow us to have cheap energy. And that cheap energy is so important because it allows us to have a very viable, efficient economy.
Right. And you also address in here the fact that we were always energy dependent by importing. And then 2020, we became energy independent by exporting a lot of coal, exporting everything else. And so that is a huge transitional point in 2020.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think one of the first early chapters, I go through each of the fossil fuels, oil, natural gas, and coal. And we have in this country, in our country, we have the largest reserves of all of those. No other country in the world has the reserves of fossil fuels that we have, which is a huge strategic and economic advantage.
It's nuts. You actually, I love this. The U.S. has 264 billion barrels, Russia, 256 billion barrels, Saudi Arabia, 212 billion in reserve. I mean, we're over Russia, and people don't realize that.
I mean, people forget that we not only have what the Gulf of Mexico and the Permian Basin and all that, we've got Alaska, which has a huge amount of untapped reserves. So we're very fortunate.
And coal. Coal's got 249 billion tons of proven coal return. And boy, the EU is buying all the coal they can get.
Yeah, again, we're very fortunate.
Isn't it? Okay.
And, you know, actually, coal is very important, not as much for us today because we have natural gas, which is such a efficient way to generate electricity.
Right.
But countries around the world may not have natural gas. In fact, most of them don't,
right.
Which is why they're importing LNG. but they do have coal, Indonesia and India and some, and that coal is could provide a lot of people a lot of cheap energy.
One of the things that I really liked, and I'm sorry if I keep getting excited, but you'll have to slow me down occasionally, but you also had in here the clean coal tech, and I can't remember what chapter it was.
Yeah, right.
Putting in coal, our coal with the, I believe it was the new metals that you had that have allowed it to go, have allowed less pollution by using the new technology. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, actually, metallurgy has...
Yes,
come to the point that the coal-fired power plants can operate at much higher temperatures and pressures.
Right.
And that has allowed them to become much more efficient. Now, most of the coal-fired power plants that we have in the United States, all except one, were supercritical coal plants, and they operated at about 33% efficient.
Right.
But the new high-efficient, low-emission ultra supercritical coal-fired power plants operate at 45% efficiency, which is a huge improvement.
And why don't we also export that technology around the world? Because that to me seems, let's get it to Africa at a reduced rate. Let's teach people how to have less impact on the environment, but still use a lower cost fuel. I mean, wouldn't that make sense?
Oh, it makes a lot of sense. And I think countries like Indonesia and India and in Africa can use the HELA, high efficiency, low emission coal-fired power plants to generate cheap electricity. Right. And it's probably the best way for them to proceed from this point forward. But they're being deterred from doing it by this effort, international effort, I might add,
right,
to eliminate fossil fuels.
You know, and Alex Epstein, I've had the pleasure of interviewing him twice.
He's written a couple of very good books.
Isn't he cool? I love his aspect on it in the humanitarian aspect. And you take a look of crossing your quote, which is way cool, and saying that it elevates up out of prosperity because of the low cost. It would make sense for us to take a look at nuclear, your numbers in here, I'm sorry, those numbers are fabulous when you start looking at the kilowatt per hour chart. Let me see if I can find that here real quick. You have, where is it? The cost per kilowatt hour. Oh, well, I'll find that. We'll talk about that later. You lay out the difference of cost per kilowatt hour, where it was years ago and where it is now after renewables. And I believe there's such like a 40% increase in kilowatt. It was 7 cents, 9 cents, whatever that number was. And it's now up to, you know, even more by gigantic standards because of the addition of the requirements for renewables. And nobody's calculating that in because those are some important numbers. Let me go ahead and throw.
Yeah, no, I know the chart you're referring to. That was in my book, The Looming Energy Crisis, and then in this book too.
Right.
A little bit of history is required here. Back around 2000, FERC, the Federal Energy Commission, proposed that the grid be managed differently than it had been in the past. In the past, the grid had been managed by each individual utility, overseen by regulators, state regulators. But FERC proposed that they set up regional transmission organizations and independent system operators who would then control and manage the grid within their areas. And about two-thirds of the country is now managed by RTOs and ISOs.
Right.
And one-third is still managed the old-fashioned way with utilities and regulators. And right, that chart you refer to shows that those areas that have adopted RTOs and ISOs,
right,
their electricity is now much more expensive than the electricity being produced in the areas manage the old-fashioned way. And the reason for that is that the RTOs and ISOs have established procedures whereby they are forcing wind and solar onto the grid.
Right.
And wind and solar, especially when you add in backup and battery support, is much more expensive than generating electricity with natural gas, coal, or nuclear.
There's a couple formulas that I want to bring up in here that were critical that nobody's really talking about, and I love those. Your average increase in this chart from 2003 to 2019, chart, average increase was 64% on what you just described.
Yeah.
That's nuts. I mean, good grief. Now, the reason, if I understood this correctly, was because of the additional power required that was in a different chart that you had regular standard of extra required power for the grid for coal and natural gas, I believe was 10%. I'm just going to throw that number out there somewhere for the extra power. And then for when you added in renewables, the extra power that you needed to, in order to sustain the grid was astronomically higher. I mean,
I think you're referring to the reserve margins.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, historically, the NERC, another group that engineering group that supports FERC, had pointed out that I forget the exact number, but they say that you needed to have between 10 and 15% reserve capacity,
right,
in order to ensure that you only had one incident every 10 years, an incident being blackout or a brownout.
Right.
So every utility used to have between 10 and 15% reserve capacity.
Right.
That reserve capacity was over and above the peak that they had ever had before. So right. That if they had a problem with weather or equipment, they would always have enough backup capacity to generate the electricity needed to keep right. the grid from having blackouts. Now, that's been turned upside down with the addition of wind and solar.
Right.
Because wind and solar are unreliable. No matter how you try to manipulate them,
right.
they just may not be there when you need them. The wind may not blow and the sun may not shine. And if they're not there when you need them, then you have blackouts.
Right.
And that's what happened in Texas a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that was not too good.
A couple hundred people died because of that.
Yes, and people were getting $1,000 electric bills overnight. You know, it's kind of like, oh my goodness. Now, when you take a look at, I interviewed Shortening the Grin with Meredith Anglin, and she is way cool too. She is a big nuclear fan.
Yes,
and the numbers that you also talked about in here, where once you get to that 10 to 15%, you have to add so much more renewable. And some of the old calculations that I was looking at, which were great in here, were so people are thinking they're a windmill or a wind tower can generate, let's just say, one gigawatt or whatever the farm is going to do. But then you need to do, let's say you have one windmill, it generates X number of kilowatts per hour. In order to do that one, you have to add in another 100 in order to get the grid balanced, whatever those numbers match out. People are not adding that cost in when they're calculating the cost of a wind farm. Does that make sense?
No, you're entirely right. I mean,
okay,
the wind turbines, their capacity factors are down in the 30%, which means that they're only generating electricity maybe 30% of the time. So they're
right.
Their nameplate rating may be 1 megawatt,
right?
But that's overstating how much electricity they're actually generating,
right?
Because they're only generating about a third of that,
right? So you need, in order to get the same, let's say 10 megawatts, you're going to need 30 of the windmills.
You need three times as much. I mean, as compared to a natural gas power plant. Yeah, because natural gas power plants, if they're allowed to operate without having to follow the load, they can operate up around 85% capacity factor.
Your numbers, I went to Oklahoma State University, so I have to use a crayon on my crayon math. I did graduate, not very high a score though. But when you sit back and take a look, I love this line. It was on page 58. The total number of new wind turbines needed to produce 2.5 megawatts to achieve net zero carbon by 2050 is 995,000 new windmills. And then the average to be installed units must be installed. We got to install 35,000 a year to hit that number.
Yeah.
And we can't do that.
No, I mean, that's where net zero is absolutely ridiculous. Because I mean, I went through, and it's in that chapter there, I went through wind, solar, and nuclear, and also combine them. And it's impossible to achieve net zero. It just is not feasible.
No.
Especially if you try to do it by 2050, which is the goal.
And so your numbers are going to sit right here, because I think that this is fun. And then when I was lucky enough to interview Gregory Wrightstone twice, and he also did a nice intro to your book.
Yeah.
I love his thoughts that CO2 is not always that bad. Trees like it. So there is the argument which one, but yours is dealing in number and dealing in financing. Because it's my unprofessional opinion, if you print money in order to pay for something that is not technologically okay, means inflation's going to hit.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. People don't seem to understand.
Yeah, that's right.
Print money, inflation, poor people get poorer. That's my OSU crayon math.
No matter how you do it with crayons or pens, it comes out the same.
It does.
Yeah.
Now, I love EVs. I love the fact that electronic vehicles are great. Okay. Super. But the technology's not there yet as well. Now, if you give me a hybrid, I think that that's a great way to use best of both worlds. You get a hybrid and you get 50 miles per gallon. That's starting to make a little sense to me. You know, 75 miles per gallon. Wait a minute, because you use half the battery, use half that. Okay, that technology is here. It's making sense. But your numbers on the EV kind of like make it frightening, because if the EV lasts, the batteries need to be changed after 8 years. And after 8 years, let's say you sell it at 10 years and the battery still works, but that person is going to have to put in a $10,000 battery upgrade. All of a sudden, you got a worthless car.
Yeah, actually, that's an interesting. I went through the arithmetic there about the difference between internal combustion engines and battery powered vehicles.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, the internal combustion engine, the drivetrain, the engine and transmission, they last the full 12 years,
right,
whatever it is, 12 years of life of the vehicle.
Right.
That's not true with the battery. Battery has to be replaced. So
right,
that adds to the cost.
I don't trade cars very often. I 250, 300,000 on mine. I get kind of used to a car. I don't trade it off very often. You know, if I just get it molded in just right, that's okay with me.
I'm with you. Actually, I do keep my cars a long time. But you mentioned the hybrids. I wrote an article. I used one of my neighbors who has a hybrid as an example, because down here where we live, you really don't have to travel very far to do what you're doing.
Right.
And she, her hybrid can go like 48 miles, I think it was, on battery.
Right.
Before it kicks over to gasoline. And yet most of her trips every day are like less than 30 miles.
Right.
So she's actually traveling using virtually no gasoline and
right,
just battery power, because she only travels 30 to 40 miles every day. And so the hybrid just makes a lot of sense when you think about it in those terms.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, if I was going to do something and I would get a hybrid and a regular gasoline car, because I travel between my houses, a little long drive, you know, I do a lot more than that, because I go back and forth between Oklahoma and Texas. Now, a hybrid would make it.
Yeah, you know? But so anyway, Toyota is the only one that's really still pushing that concept. I think it's a good concept.
Oh, I do too. And I loved your math on that. I'll tell you what, Don, as you go through this, I'm highly recommending all of your books. I recommend everybody follow you on your blog. How can people find your book, or how can people find you?
Well, first of all, the book is available on Amazon. It's easy to get. All my books are available on Amazon, at least the ones that are still in print. The Looming Energy Crisis. That book is, if anybody wants to understand how the grid operates and how the grid is being managed,
right?
That's the book that explains it. And yes. In fact, I actually refer to it a couple of times in my new book, Clean Energy Crisis, because it's part of the equation as to why we have a problem in trying to get replace fossil fuels with renewables.
Right. And again, thank you so much. So Amazon and your blog.
Just go to Power for USA is the name of the blog.
Okay.
And I think you can get to it with D Deers or whatever, but either Power for USA or D Deers.
I'll tell you what, we're going to have all that in the show notes, and we will publish this out. We'll get it out to all of the channels and everything else. And so we really thank you for stopping by.
Well, great. This has been a great interview, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk about some of these topics, which I find extremely important. They're extremely important because if we follow this idea of trying to get rid of fossil fuels, it could actually destroy our country.
World. I'll take it one step further.
All right.
And by the way, thank you.